and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, self-help books, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. This is episode 11, and you can find the show notes at ump.fm. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a man who's been a mainstay of Mac and Apple tech journalism for many years, with stints at MacUser, Macworld, and TechHive, where he was senior editor, and work published further afield in publications like The Magazine and The Boston Globe. He also has a pretty good shot at the biggest Star Wars fanboy in the world title, despite some serious competition, much of it from his fellow regular panellists on the Incomparable podcast. He is, of course, Mr. Dan Morin. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anthony. It's so nice to be here.
Good to have you with us. I just want to preface this episode. Regular listeners will know, or, you know, people of the future listening to this now will know that it's pretty 50-50 if I like the stuff that people pick. Mm-hmm. You know, that already we're only on episode 11, and already it's fairly 50-50 whether or not I'm a fan of something as well as the guest. This is one of those cases where I am an ardent fan, and in fact, one of the few cases where I specifically asked somebody onto the show to talk about a specific movie, because frankly, there aren't enough people who love it, and there really should be more. So, Mr. Morin, please tell us what you've chosen, and then give us some context around its release, its reception upon release, why you think it's maligned, and why you think those people are terribly, terribly wrong.
Well, I have chosen the, I would say, seminal 1991 classic American action comedy film, Hudson Hawk. This is a movie that starred Bruce Willis, not too far out of his sort of hitting it big in Die Hard. It is an incredibly bizarre film that I think was met upon its release by a lot of sort of head-scratching people trying to figure out if this was just a Bruce Willis vanity project, and he was involved with the production of the movie, and I think he helped write the story for it as well. So
yes, he did, yeah.
A lot of people sort of thinking this was just a very self-indulgent project, and it centers upon a cat burglar played by Bruce Willis who gets involved with a plot to steal some inventions of Leonardo da Vinci. And if you feel like that's not a bizarre enough plot line in and of itself, then you can integrate a number of strange slaps. It's half slapstick comedy with incredibly bad puns at points, and among other things, a heist set to musical numbers. So I feel like I can understand why not everybody would go gaga over this film, because it is a very, very eccentric, esoteric type of movie. But personally, I adore it. And I think that's because it sort of plays to all of the sensibilities that I love. It does the action, it does the comedy, and it doesn't take itself too seriously, I think, is the thing that I love the most about it. There is a sort of willful suspension of disbelief of even the characters themselves in the movie about some of the totally bizarre things that happen. And that sort of being able to poke fun at oneself, especially for someone like Bruce Willis, who really sort of made his chops in comedy rather than become, you know, before he became a big action star, he was best known for doing sort of comedic work. Mm-hmm. So I think he's a very strong comedian. I don't think it's something that it's a muscle that he gets to use as much these days. He's become sort of a dry, straight man a lot of times. But if you go back and look at his work in, you know, the 80s, a lot of it is much more ridiculous comedy, or even just, you know, sharp-witted dialogue. If you look at something like Moonlighting, his long-running TV show with Cybill Shepherd, you know, that focused much more on the comedic aspect. So I personally love Hudson Hawk because I feel that even though it is so bizarre, there's just nothing else like it. Like, I would be hard-pressed to come up with another movie.
There really isn't, no.
Yeah, there's anywhere in this vein. And the fact that it is unique and so different from all the other things that were coming out at this time is what sort of endears it to me. And I've seen this movie, I don't even know how many times. A friend introduced me to it probably 15 years ago or something. And I had never even heard of it at that point. And so since that point, it has become one of my staples. And it is, there is a litmus test, I think, for it, which is to show it to other people and see if they like it or not. And that sort of gives you an idea of whether those people are in sync with your own particular tastes.
I would agree with that 100%. I mean, yeah, if you think a cat burglar stealing Leonardo da Vinci's inventions is strange, oh boy, are you in for a surprise with the rest of this movie.
I mean, scratch the surface with that.
Yeah, that's like the straightest part of this movie. when it, I actually saw this in the cinema.
Oh, wow. Oh,
when it opened. Oh, yeah, yeah. And I saw it with my high school friends. We were all in high school. Actually, no, we just left high school at the time. And we were pretty much the only people in the place. Seriously, there was nobody else there. I think maybe like two other guys in the theater. You know?
So you would know better than I then what the sort of buzz around it when it came out. Like what were people expecting from this?
There was no buzz because, well, there was up until reviews came out, and this was before the days when studios would regularly, if they thought they had a turkey, would just not let reviews out. Yeah. So reviews had come out and the reviewers were harsh, really harsh, especially over here. I mean, they were pretty harsh in the States, but they really hated it over here because it was perceived as self-indulgent claptrap.
Yeah, I can see that.
But the opening, I imagine, you know, there's me and like three, four of my friends, we're all 19, 20 years old. We're all massive diehard fans. We love Arnie movies. We love Lethal Weapon. You know, we all love sorts of movies. We're going to go and see the new Bruce Willis. It's an action adventure movie called Hudson Hawk. Fantastic. We sit down and the first, what, 5-10 minutes are about Leonardo da Vinci and some guy and a donkey.
The guy and the donkey is just a guy and the donkey, okay? But you start to, every time I show this to people, like people wonder if, Did you put in the right movie?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We literally looked at one another in the cinema and said, wait, did we come into the right, because this was a, you know, a multiplex. Did we come in the right room?
Yeah, yeah, because it is so, it has bearing on the film. Like it is certainly part of the plot, but it is divorced in many ways from the narrative that follows.
It is totally relevant, but it is also totally the wrong way to start this movie. Yeah. Oh, dear. Listeners will know on episode 6, we had Alison Berry talking about Last Action Hero. Mm. Now, I don't know how you feel about that movie, but this one predates that by several years. But I feel like they have a lot in common because this was made, as you say, while Bruce Willis was riding high. He just released Die Hard 2, was not as successful as Die Hard, but it was still very successful and pretty much had a license to make whatever he wanted. As you say, it poked fun at adventure movies, which was the kind of movies that he was, you know, really riding high on at that point. Mm-hmm. But to really get it, you had to be a fan of those movies as well.
Right.
And much like Last Action Hero, I'm not sure how much of the audience has a sense of humor about it, frankly.
I actually will say I have not actually seen that movie, so I can't.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. Well, as some people might know, I also do a podcast with my friend Lex Friedman called Not Playing with Lex and Dan, where it turns out that he and I have missed a lot of really sort of both popular and cult movies over the last 20 years, so we try to go through. But that's a good one. I may have to add that one to the list.
Yeah, well, and that show is where I first heard you talk about Hudson Hawk.
Right, because we did an episode about that.
And realized that you were a fan, yeah. But yeah, they are very similar in that sense. And also in the reception. In that they were both massive flops with everyone calling it a self-indulgent ego trip.
Yeah, right. So, and I think, you know, in a movie where probably the most consistent plot point is that the main character cannot get a cappuccino, you know, I can understand why people would think that this is all just sort of, you know, Bruce Willis kind of doing whatever the hell he wants. And I think that's okay to a certain extent. I mean, it is a self-indulgent movie in some ways, but at the same time, I feel that there is something about it that succeeds despite all of that. And it's definitely not a movie that fits easily, as we discussed, in any boxes. Like, even though it is an action comedy movie, you know, there are so many parts which are so much heavier on the comedy, but it's not like a parody. It's not like a, you know, like a Hot Shots
right,
or something like that, where it's just like joke a minute, right? There's actually, there is a plot you know, loosely speaking.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you can sort of follow it as you go along. And I just showed this recently to my girlfriend who had not seen it before. And she kept giving me skeptical looks the entire time.
You got the side eye.
Yeah, exactly. But I know she's a big fan of things like puns and does like, you know, some slapstick comedy. So I thought I felt pretty confident. And by the end of it, she was willing to admit that she enjoyed it, although she did agree that it is incredibly bizarre and doesn't really make sense for a lot of it. So I think she was kind of on the fence, but I think she was tipping in the direction of really liking it. That's what I keep telling myself anyways.
The comedy is literally cartoon. Like, they even use cartoon sound effects in, you know, in some instances. But it is kind of, it's charming.
Right.
I think it's a fun-loving, charming kind of comedy where nobody, I mean, yes, I can say nobody gets seriously hurt. That's not true. People die all over the place, but they die in a cartoon fashion.
Right. It's exaggerated. It's over the top.
Exactly. It's so over the top that you laugh rather than cringe.
Well, I mean, and I think in particular, my favorite example of that in this movie is there's a scene, the great sequence where he gets pushed out of the ambulance and he's on the gurney, sort of on the bridge, you know, and for one thing, he's on the, you know, the wheeled gurney, and he's still going the entire time, even though, you know, physics would probably dictate that, you know, he would get slowed down or stopped. But no, he goes, you know, he's riding along.
He even overtakes some cars at one point, I
believe. Right, he passes cars, he catches a cigarette someone throws out the window, and then he throws the correct change in the toll booth. But then you have that scene where they the crime brothers, the Mario brothers. I love that. So many little understated references, but they're driving in the ambulance and they hit a curve and the ambulance like goes off, you know, turns over, does one of those flips, and in midair, before it's hit anything, it explodes into flame. So, you know, kind of parodying, I feel like, in some ways, you'll explain like the A-Team from the 80s, where they always did the over the top, you know, like, oh yeah, the car went off the cliff and then burst into fire. And so, you know, that element of it is so exaggerated and over the top, there's no conceivable reason for an ambulance to burst into flames as it before it impacts anything, but you kind of go with it.
You definitely have to watch Last Action Hero.
Okay, it's on the list.
On paper, this looked like, you can see why it got greenlit. I mean, yeah, Bruce Willis's fame aside, you can see why somebody would look at it on paper and go, yeah, okay. Because just look at the credits.
Yes.
I mean, Michael Lehman's had a really checkered career, but for this, he was coming off the back of Heathers,
right,
which is, you know, a genuine cult classic.
Mm-hmm.
He also did Airheads. He's done The Truth About Cats and Dogs.
Yeah.
He kind of feels like a guy who's never been given his due. And the writing team, I mean, Willis did co-write the story. I don't know whether he co-conceived it, but he certainly co-wrote it. And you have to imagine that he probably had a fairly firm hand on the screenplay just because he was the big star. But you've also got people like Stephen E. DeSouza, who wrote stuff like Die Hard itself and Schwarzenegger movies like Commando and The Running Man. Daniel Waters, who wrote Heathers and Demolition Man, which is another movie, by the way, that I feel is unjustly maligned. So this is mostly a team of people who've all worked together before. So you'd think that would, you know, you can see Joel Silver, for heaven's sake, looking.
And he's looking a producer god at this point too, right? Yeah. You know, it has all the ingredients, I feel like. It's definitely good. And you've got a lot of great cast members, Andy McDowell, James Coburn, David Caruso, kind of on the early side of his career. Frank Stallone, the lesser known of the Stallone brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Sandra Bernhard and Richard E. Grant, who plays one of the villains here and is fabulous.
He plays such a good villain, doesn't he?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I had read at some point something about one of his, you know, recollections of this movie, and it didn't sound entirely positive, but he's so good here, and he and Bernhard are both, again, completely exaggerate caricatures of villains. They have no real, you know, plan or anything like that, but they're, you know, they're kind of like set up to people who want to be supervillains.
Yeah, exactly. This is jumping way ahead, but the bit at the end where their plan appears to have worked and they appear to be basically about to destroy modern society as we know it. And Richard E. Grant is like doing the, you know, the pelvic thrust, humping the air in victory. You're right that in later interviews, he's said that it was kind of chaotic and hellish because they were literally getting script rewrites there on set.
Right.
But you can tell that he's enjoying playing the character.
Right. Well, I mean, I think a lot of actors enjoy playing villains because it gives them a license to do things that they don't get to do playing, you know, heroes or supporting characters. So I can definitely see that. In particular, the two actors I always enjoy calling out are David Caruso, who plays an incredibly bizarre role in this movie of a CIA henchman who doesn't speak but only communicates by handing over like little business card sized things with his lines written on them, essentially, and who occasionally dresses up as other characters or other objects. At one point, he's disguised as a statue. But such a bizarre role for an actor to not have any lines in the entire movie. But something about that character for me is always delightful, and he does come to an unfortunate end. But that points out for one of me the one of the best sort of surreal moments of this film, which is as he is, you know, double crossed and shot and falls to the ground, all these cards spill out of him. And so for the entire movie, you've been wondering, how does he get these little cards that have the perfect lines of dialogue in them? And of course, you realize at the end he's had all of them on him all the time, which is, you know, at the same time is within the perfect logic of this movie, and yet makes no real sense whatsoever.
It's Batman hiding under Commissioner Gordon's desk.
Yes, exactly. It's
the, what way, you know, you turn around and he's gone. Like, where is he? And then you pan down and he's hiding under the desk. Yeah, what is it? My name is Kit Kat. This is not a dream.
Yeah. Beware the green wire. Yeah. And I really enjoy, and you know, he's kind of becomes one of the few sort of sympathetic villainous characters, if you will, because he does seem to have a genuinely soft streak for, you know, some of the characters, and in particular it helps Andy McDowell's character towards the end. But I think he ends up being kind of sympathetic, but it's such a fascinating, surreal element to that.
Well, the whole CIA team is surreal. So you've got James Coburn playing this CIA, you know, guy, big shot. And then his entire team, they're all named after, I assume they're all American candy bars.
Yes.
You've got Snickers, who appears to be like a sort of the tech guy, you know, the guy with the glasses that you always have. You have Almond Joy, who is a sort of female hard ass. You got Kit Kat, David Caruso's character, who is the mime and mimic. And
Butterfinger,
that's it, yeah. Played by
Andrew Bryniarski.
That's it, Bryniarski, yeah. Because when I first saw the movie, I thought that was the Boz. Because I think this was around the time that the Boz had just retired from injury, and I was like, wait, is that... But no, it's not.
Yeah, he's a former bodybuilder, but he is gigantic.
Yeah,
he's a really big guy, and of course he's also kind of clumsy and kind of dumb too, so you get kind of all those with him. I will point out my other favorite homage from this movie is the fact that James Coburn's character is named George Kaplan, which fans of Hitchcock movies will know is the fake spy in North by Northwest that Cary Grant is constantly confused with, but turns out to not exist at all. And so, you know, getting a movie, which admittedly, this is probably on the opposite end of the spectrum from something that like North by Northwest, which I also adore, which is unquestionably a really good movie. I love that that's a little tip of the hat there to Hitchcock. And again, it goes into making this movie such a weird combination of elements that range from sort of the highbrow-ish to just really, really, as you point out with the Richard Grant pelvic thrust before, like all the way down to sort of the most base humor you can think of.
I can't believe I missed that George Kaplan. I can't believe I never made that connection before.
It just jumped out to me the first time I saw it, and I was like, wait, where do I know that name from? Oh, that's right. That's from North by Northwest.
Man. I think maybe I just haven't seen, I never watched either movie close enough in time to sort of, yeah, oh, wow. Yeah, that's even better. we have to talk about one of the most memorable things in this, and really, because after I saw it at the cinema, I liked it. Most of my mates thought it was just bizarre and, you know, didn't know whether they liked it or not, but I thought it was great. But I didn't see it again for some time. This was, again, you know, when this came out, it was before, you know, VHS libraries and stuff were around,
sure, yeah.
But it's not like you could just go and buy a VHS within a month of the movie coming out.
Right.
And certainly long before DVDs. So it was many years before I saw it again. And in that intervening time, it was the song length to time the job gimmick. That was the thing I remembered more than anything else about this movie, because I'm pretty sure that's the first time anybody, you know, has did that. And it's even if you don't like the movie, you have to admit that that is a pretty awesome idea. It's a great gimmick.
It's a fantastic sequence, too. And you know, Bruce Willis and Danny Aiello may not have the best singing voices, but I think they acquit themselves
they
pretty well.
By.
Yeah, I actually have a somewhere, I have an MP3 of their rendition of Swingin' on a Star.
A pig is an animal with dirt on his face. His shoes are a terrible disgrace.
He's got no manners when he eats his food. He's fat and lazy and extremely rude.
But if you don't care a feather or a fig, you may grow up to be a pig. And all the monkeys on in the zoo, every day you see quite a few.
So you see, it's all up to you.
You could be better than you are. Could be swinging on a star.
Got the horse head?
Just got out of jail yesterday and I'm robbing an auction house.
Which is just fantastic. And that the whole scene where they're robbing an auction house and it's all timed to this because, again, a conceit that really doesn't make much sense as Danny Aiello's character Tommy even points out, you know, while you were in prison, they invented these things called watches.
Yeah.
So, yes, there are easier ways to do this. But it's so charming to the fact that they're, you know, they're singing and dancing and running around. You know, it's kind of like half musical almost in some ways, but they never quite fully commit to the musical idea. There's only a couple sequences, but it is delightful. And I don't know why it's just so much fun to watch, but it's timed very well. It's edited and shot very well. And it is such a clever idea. And they're going throughout the movie, they go back and forth about naming songs. And there's even throwaway lines where people will, you know, say lines that are also the names of songs, and he will always come back with the time for how long that song is, which you can easily miss if you're not really paying attention. There's a lot of surprisingly good little bits dropped here and there, like lines that you would ride right over if you weren't paying attention, that are just little throwaway lines that are actually great quips or references to things elsewhere in the movie.
Yeah, and I wonder how many people did ride straight over them. And, you know, maybe that's one of the reasons why the movie didn't get that great. Danny Aiello, he's so good, man. I miss him.
He was fantastic in this.
He was so, so good. I think maybe part of the reason why those sequences are so enjoyable is because they're really well choreographed as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that they are dance numbers,
right,
but you just the way they move throughout the sequence and throughout the scene is almost like a dance. You can, you know, it is literally choreographed, and it's, yeah, everything times well, and bits of interaction with the scenery, you know, are timed to coincide with parts of the song and stuff. It's just, yeah.
Right. You get the idea that, you know, these guys are, this is in some ways effortless for them, right? That's how unconcerned they are, is they're like, we're just going to walk around and sing while we're robbing this place because we know we're so good that it won't make a difference.
And then there's Andy McDowell, of course.
Yes.
And yes, she's beautiful and everything, but she is also a good actress.
Uh-huh.
And I think she's really underrated in this, actually, because especially towards the end, when unfortunately she becomes the damsel in distress, it's not an easy role to pull off without not going far enough, or then, you know, you go too far. And she, I think she pulls it off and manages to, you know, sort of just be on the edge.
Right. Well, and then she does get asked to do all these sorts of really bizarre things. For one thing, she's a secret agent of this Vatican organization. And in one of the moments of perhaps slightly heretical humor, I love, there's a scene where she goes to say something to a crucifix, essentially, and then the crucifix lights up with, like, because it's like an intercom.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I think, you know, perhaps I enjoy a little bit of the blasphemy too much, but it's such a great scene. But I think it's interesting you point out the damsel in distress part, because that did come up, you know, while I was watching this with my girlfriend, who often, you know, is very cognizant about that sort of things. But there is a great line at one point where she's, you know, she is tied to a chair or something and being interrogated. And, you know, Hudson Hawk and Tommy are out, you know, trying to take care of all these goons. And she basically escapes and she runs up and, you know, Hudson Hawk's like, oh, we're coming to rescue you. And she's like, nah, I got bored, so I rescued myself.
Yeah, that's true.
And I thought that was a great way to sort of even undercut this. And, you know, we're talking about a movie that's almost 25 years old. And I think those concerns were probably not as prominent at that point as they are today. We think about those roles and about those sort of tropes a lot more today than we probably did 25 years ago. But it was nice to have that moment of, she has a lot of agency in the film, even, if she is a love interest and at times, you know, placed in sort of some sort of distress. But I think she is also a really strong character in a lot of ways. And it's nice to see she plays off Bruce Willis really well. They do actually, I feel like, have chemistry in this movie.
I agree. And she also delivers that lovely line.
Father, we've been double-crossed by the CIA.
Yeah. The Pope warned me never to trust the CIA.
the Jewish Catholic priest.
I love that. Every time I hear that guy, he's got the, we will not roll over for some schmuck from New Jersey.
Like, he even goes, ay-yi-yi at one point.
So it's, again, such surreal, bizarre humor that if you're not paying attention or you're not engaged in this film, I feel like you would just not think that's weird. But there, to me, the juxtaposition, the fact that it is so much out of line with what you expect, is what makes it delightfully funny, is that it does sort of subvert all of these things and seems to not really, doesn't draw a lot of attention to them, isn't like hanging a big sign on it saying, ah, look at this, this is funny. It just, it's subtle. And I think it's surprisingly subtle for a movie that at other parts is so ostentatious.
I think some of the humor definitely comes from humor about filmmaking, if that makes sense, you know, sort of relying on the audience not having a certain amount of knowledge about Hollywood and how movies get made.
There is some of that meta humor. Like, I think, you know, there's a scene at the end of the auction house sequence where they jump off a building and go through, you know, an awning. And the cut is they fall directly into armchairs in an apartment somewhere.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But they react as though they have just fallen off the building. Like there's a consistent, like a through line there, which is weird. And again, goes to your point as earlier as like being cartoonish. Because that's not something we would be used to seeing in a movie, in an action movie, or even a lot of comedies, is that sort of, it's almost a fourth wall breaking thing.
It's the sort of thing you'd expect to see, actually, thinking about it, in an Edgar Wright movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Huh.
Was that the motion of the camera following, sort of tracking the motion of the action, and then being sort of, irreverent or surreal, you know, breaking you out of the world of the movie a little bit.
Also, talking about, the sort of cartoonish coincidence stuff, one of the things that always cracked me up was when he is on the chicken truck. This is a truck full of chickens, apparently, just going through the city, as you do. And it goes around a corner, he falls off, and he lands in the chair at the table where he was supposed to be having dinner with Andy McDowell.
Right.
Because he's late.
And then he blows a little feather out of his hand, too. again, showing just Bruce Willis's facility with doing physical comedy, which is something I think he doesn't get as much chance to do. There's also a scene earlier in that chase where he, you know, hits a TV aerial, and we get a cut to the Pope watching Mr. Ed dubbed in Italian, and the signal goes all fuzzy, and the Pope starts banging on it with his staff, which, again, a little bit more of that sort of blasphemous type humor, but enjoyable. Actually, I think most of this Vatican scene, a lot of which I think is shot in, at least in Rome or parts of it, because there are some, like, they drive by the Vatican. They either do a really good job of compositing some shots together, or they actually shot on location, which I would imagine they did.
I don't think compositing was that good in 1991.
Yeah,
right. Frankly.
Yeah, it's cheaper just to fly him to Italy and put a camera in it. But I personally love the entire Vatican Museum heist, which is sort of the odd one out here because it doesn't involve any sort of musical timing and he's doing it on his own. But it has this great scene. I love this scene where he's casing the joint early on and he sort of ducks his minders. And then he sort of is figuring out what he needs to do this. And there's a scene where he's walking down these stairs and there's a little girl with a stuffed elephant and she's just wailing the stuffed elephant against the railing. And her mother grabs her and like, Courtney, you're embarrassing your country.
Yeah.
Which is such a perfect line for anybody who's ever traveled abroad and seen, especially Americans, especially American children, embarrassing their country. And of course, the elephant then suffers a sad fate as it's used to trip an alarm and gets smushed beneath a gate.
British tourists abroad are equally embarrassing, I assure you.
Really? No, see, I would not have said that, but I'll take your word for it.
For different reasons, but yeah. Also, I had to call out in that scene when he, and the way he even gets to Rome in itself is just surreal and, you know, amusing, where they knock him out and he just falls into a packing carton and then wakes up in the room and looks out and there's the Colosseum.
That's happened to me. It hasn't happened to you.
I do like, I love a comedy that's much, and this is much like the bit where they fall on the awning, where it's like, do we need to explain that? No, just move on. Just
right,
move on.
Exactly, exactly. Don't spend too much time. This is not a movie where you're going to spend time explaining the logic of how things work.
How things happen, yeah, yeah.
Because that would just, that would, in my mind, that's what would ruin the movie, is if you went through and tried to make it all, quote-unquote, make sense. I feel like you rob all the charm, you rob all the comedy of it, and that would be the far bigger failure to my mind.
I agree. But what I actually wanted to point out was some serious high-waisted trouser action going on in that scene, because they give him a change of clothes, and they are, I don't think they're Versace, but it's one of those, you know, it is designer right. stuff. And yeah, he's like, whoa, his belt's like right under his pecs. Some serious 80s pleated trouser high waist stuff going on.
I hear that was in.
Apparently so, yeah, yeah. I can't say I ever saw it myself. Oh, but then, you know, I was in England. Oh, when they're having dinner, this again is a reflection. This isn't, you know, that funny, but it's a good reflection again of Andy McDowell being underrated when she realizes, I think he let slip that he was in prison.
Yes.
And she sort of shoots him a look, and he says, I was a warden?
Yeah.
And she says nothing. She doesn't say a word. She just pulls a sort of face, a sort of regretful squint.
Yeah.
To say, no, I'm not going to believe that. And it's just, it's beautifully done. It's beautifully timed. And again, that takes a very good actor, a better actress than I think Andy McDowell gets credit for, to pull off.
Right. And I think you're right that a lot of the stuff that she does is underrated in this film, because she's sort of the straight man to a lot of the wackiness going on. Though I do really appreciate the scenes later on, you know, there's where they're working together more. She knocks him out with a cappuccino at one point, and then there's a line alluding to that later where he wants a coffee. She says, oh, but I'm sorry, the machine's still set to poisonous foam.
Oh, yeah.
And she delivers them very nicely, very smoothly. And then she does get that incredibly bizarre sequence towards the end where they're trying to get information out of her, and she's been drugged.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She's just like talking to herself and doing all these voices and doing dolphin sounds. And it's so weird. That there's so much trouble envisioning Andy McDowell from any other role doing that, because it's so just beyond the realm of imagining. But she, for me, again, I just think it's hilarious. It's great. It's great physical like comedy where she's doing these like, you must pay the rent, but I can't pay the rent, and like, you know, and you're just sitting there going, what is this? But it's delightful because she does nail it somehow. And I find that you're right that to go from those extremes of you know, being sort of the skeptical straight man all the way to having to do the comedy yourself does take incredible range and incredible dynamism as an actor.
And talking about physical comedy, Kung Fu James Coburn. I'd completely forgotten about that until I rewatched this in preparation for the show. And I was like, oh yeah, he puts on the full military fatigues and a beret. Hi-ya!
Yeah.
And then just, yeah. And of course, I love that they don't even try to hide that it's a stuntman.
Right, right. And but although they do this weird, the weird sort of tip of the hat at one point where Bruce Willis is holding out a 2x4, and he does
yes.
this sort of 3 kicks in a row to and chops the 2x4 increasingly smaller, and then stops and he's dizzy.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, yeah, I mean, James Coburn, he was probably in his like 60s or 70s at that point. And so it's little things like that where they get the tip of the hat to things that, you know, like, okay, we're going to sort of admit that we're being ridiculous and that this wouldn't play out this way. And to me, not to, you know, we are jumping around a little bit, but to me, the best example of this is actually the end of the movie, where Tommy Fivetone, Danny Aiello, has been locked in a limousine that is going off the edge of a cliff that explodes into flames on the way down.
And actually has a bomb in it. This isn't just a random Hollywood exploding car. It does actually have a bomb.
Yeah, a bomb is attached to the back of the car. Explodes. Falls off a cliff, you know, 100 feet down. And you're like, well, he's really, you know, he's really gone. And we sort of move on, and Bruce Willis and Andy McDowell escape, and they get to the end, and they follow in this little Italian village, and they're like, well, you know, we only wish Tommy were here. And then he rides in on a donkey, totally singed, and they're like, How did you survive? And he goes, you know, airbags. You believe it?
Yeah,
and
sprinkler like, system.
So yeah, how was the, but you were on fire. Sprinkler system in the back. Do you believe it? And then Bruce Willis has the line that sums up the entire movie for me, which is, yeah, that must be what happened.
Yeah, that's probably like, what happened. Let's go with it. Yeah,
he just totally talks himself into it. And I think at that point, it's the sort of acknowledgement that that's where we have all had to get for the entire movie. Is to that point of saying, like, just go with it. You know, just say, this is happening. I'm just going to ride the wave. And I love that not even they take it seriously. They don't even have to overthink, like, no, that would actually be impossible. You would be blown into little bits. They're just going to go with it. And I think that to me is sort of the summation of what the tone of this entire movie is that it doesn't take itself seriously at all. There is not a single bit of this movie, I think, that you could interpret as a serious drama. And that's fine. That's fine. We don't need every movie to have elements of the serious drama. There's been so much focus, especially in recent years, on sort of dark, gritty, realistic movies. Every superhero movie, and I think being able to step away from that and say, like, let's do something that doesn't fit in any box is kind of the joy of this.
If there is a serious line in it, and it comes off the back of a comedy line, but when Danny Aiello's character goes off the cliff in the limo and blows up, and Richard E. Grant's character has just escaped that very same limo, so he's just escaped that fate, and he stands there, and Bruce Willis is looking down on him from a balcony above, and Richard E. Grant just turns around, spreads his arms, and goes, "Friend of yours?" And Bruce Willis just jabs a finger down at him and goes, "Dead!" Which is kind of the closest thing to a serious moment in the movie, but even that makes me laugh.
Well, yeah, and then he grabs a rope and swings down like Douglas Fairbanks style. Yep. So you know, even that isn't taken super seriously at that point. And we neglected, of course, to mention another of my favorite sort of minor roles in this, which is the butler, who of course is named Alfred, who also has knives that pop out of his coat, you know, sort of switchblade type things that up his sleeves, which I love because he's, you know, again, a total caricature, a total parody of all the Jeeves, Alfred, whatever butlers you want to name. And you know, we are introduced to this character where he kills someone, rather viciously, and then says something, I think to Bruce Willis's character is like, "Oh, about your cut," you know, and then says, "Forgive my dry British humor."
Yeah. He's one of those characters who's completely amoral.
Right.
And actually sort of revels in his, ability to, you know, kill and maim and cause chaos and what have you. Yeah, which is such a stereotype for that kind of British assassin character. He's never ruffled. He's right. Always perfectly presented.
But he does have the best, probably the best death scene in the movie.
Yes.
Where Bruce Willis, you know, basically decapitates him with his own knives and then has what is my favorite line from the entire movie. It was
like, "You won't be attending that hat convention in July."
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, a sort of barometer line where, like, if you don't find that line funny, this is not the movie for you.
It's, I mean, you know, for the benefit of listeners who haven't seen this movie, there has never been any mention of any hat convention in July or at any other point in this entire movie.
yeah. That's about right.
Yeah. It's the worst sort of Bond quip ever, which is, yeah, why it's
exactly
hilarious.
Exactly. Yeah. Bond movies are sort of a good comparison, like, because this is almost, and they, you know, I was looking at the Wikipedia entry, and of course they compare it a little bit to Coburn's own Our Man Flint movies, which are themselves parodies of sort of the James Bond, 1960s James Bond movies. And there is definitely an element of this that feels sort of like those, you know, especially like some of the Roger Moore ones that are just over the top, ridiculous,
crazy, like Moonraker.
Yeah, Moonraker, yeah. Exactly. And things that don't make any sense and are totally slapsticky and exaggerated. And there's definitely a lot of this in that. And you can kind of understand that coming from, you know, the 90s. I always interested by the context of this movie and its release, right? Because we had talked about this being off the heels of Bruce Willis's success as an action movie star. But I feel like the 80s, you know, the 80s are such a bifurcated time when it comes to both comedy that is, I think of the comedies as being so iconic in the 80s because they're cut from a very particular cloth. You have things like John Hughes movies, Caddyshack, that kind of stuff. But also, I think there is a certain amount of grit to a lot of the movies that we saw in the 80s, and less when it comes to sort of the action movies and serious movies. I feel like there's a lot of, darker, the 70s, 80s darker tone. And I think the 90s, we start to see some rebounding of that, and then we get this sort of action comedy movie that's really cut from that Die Hard mold. I think of something like some of the Michael Bay and, John Woo action movies from the 90s, which are often have sort of the quippy hero and things like that. And I it's hard to argue that Die Hard didn't originate that. And so Hudson Hawk perhaps goes more to the comedic extreme than the action extreme, but it does feel like a commentary in some ways on, taking action movies too seriously.
Yeah, totally. And of action stars trying to do that sort of comedy.
Right. I mean,
we mentioned Last Action Hero already. There was also, the same year as this, Sylvester Stallone did a movie called Oscar.
Right.
A mafia comedy. Have you seen that?
I have not, but I remember hearing about it.
I put it in the same sort of category as Hudson Hawk. It is, Stallone, who obviously up until that point was one of the biggest action stars in the world, doing comedy. And not just gentle comedy, but slapstick knockabout comedy. It came out the same year as this movie, directed by John Landis, and it bombed. It absolutely was panned. It bombed. I think it's hilarious, but it's absolutely panned. I think maybe people just weren't ready for action stars to do self-aware comedies.
Yeah, and it is weird because, again, I think of comedy and action as it's very divorced in some ways in the 70s and 80s, because especially in the 70s where you're looking at movies like, I think it's something like the French Connection or something, where it's like
right.
dead serious, super intense. And it's a great action movie, but it's also undercut with this whole like serious crime thing. And in the 80s, I think there is a lot of iconic comedy. But the action movies, I feel like maybe there's a little more backlash to things that are, especially towards the late 80s, early 90s, there's a little more backlash to things that are too gritty and too real. And you're right that it seems weird to have those like action stars doing those comedic roles. And in the 90s, I think you get a little more success because you also get things like Schwarzenegger doing True Lies, right? Which is, again, sort of a send-up of a lot of the stuff that he's done before. But it is also has legitimate action, too.
Bad Boys as well.
Bad Boys, good point, yeah.
And Last Boy Scout, which, of course, was Bruce Willis.
Yes. Exactly.
And that's not a comedy as such, but it's a much more lighthearted, later Lethal Weapon movie-style, witty action movie,
right.
I think. It's not as much of a comedy as something like Bad Boys, but Last Boy Scout is... Die Hard feels like the French Connection compared to Last Boy Scout. It's much, much lighter. And I think actually is Last Boy Scout a Michael Bay movie. I'm not sure if it is or not.
Yeah, the first one I ever saw, well, Bad Boys, I thought was his earliest one.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, the Rock later on, which I would make an argument for as Michael Bay's perhaps only really great movie.
Oh, wow, really? I thought The Rock was terrible.
Oh, well, okay. Well, we'll save that for another time.
All right. Oh, no, Last Boy Scout was Tony Scott. That's right.
Oh, Tony Scott. Yes, yeah. Of course. Top Gun and Ridley Scott's younger brother.
Sadly missed.
Again, as we're saying, it's hard to find another movie that is anywhere near what Hudson Hawk tries to accomplish. And for all these reasons, the comedy, the action, the charm. Heavy, credit due to Bruce Willis too, who, as we, as I said sort of earlier, is before this is largely a comedy star, and or a leading man, rather than sort of an action hero. The Die Hard really catapulted him in that direction, and so Bruce Willis, I feel like he carries this movie. There's no argument against that. Not that the rest of the cast isn't good, but it relies heavily on his considerable charisma.
He's in practically every scene, yeah.
Right, exactly. And the fact that he himself at times plays sort of a straight man role to what's going on and is kind of, you mentioned the Andie MacDowell thing where she doesn't buy him being in prison, but there are so many scenes where Bruce Willis is kind of like, especially the scenes that involve Sandra Bernhardt and Richard Grant's villains, where he's kind of staring at them wide-eyed like, what is going on here? And, and he is our entree into this film and our protagonist. And so the fact that even he, is weirded out at times by things that are happening or isn't quite sure what's real and what isn't real, I think goes a long way to feeling like, okay, we're willing to suspend our disbelief because Bruce Willis as our proxy is himself in disbelief.
Right. He's skeptical himself, so it's all right for us to be skeptical. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I was going to close saying that this movie was kind of ahead of its time, in the sense that you were just talking about, of the later 90s having more of that combination of action and comedy, even if not, you know, to the comedic extent that Hudson Hawk does. But on the other hand, I actually agree with you that thinking about it, I don't think there is, even if this movie had been released 6, 7, 8 years later, apart from Bruce Willis needing a better toupee, I don't think the reception would have been any different, because it is unique. There is no other movie with this combination of elements.
Yeah, and I think that it's hard to get away from the idea that this is like a vanity project, right? That, you know, having hit it big, Bruce Willis is like, oh, I can write movies and basically, you know, decide what I want to do and make that movie happen. And it's unclear to me exactly how much that is the case, but he certainly had a big impact on its production. And I think that it's hard to, you know, when we see actors as producers or writers on a movie nowadays, or directors in some case, I think it has a certain connotation to it. And, you know, there are actors who have made very successful transitions to writing and directing, but there's also a lot of actors who we think like, oh yeah, sure, he thinks he can produce a movie and because he's such a big star, even though he's not really good at that at all. And so I can understand the temptation to sort of think of that as a downside to a movie. But I wonder, you know, going in blind, and it was easy for me as someone who had never heard of this movie before then to go in fresh and just sort of be slack-jawed at what I was seeing because it didn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's a bit like rock stars becoming actors, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, yes, you can have David Bowie. Yes, you can have Henry Rollins. But, you know, you also get Mick Jagger. All right, and on that note, I think it's time to close this out. Dan Warren, thank you very much. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, I'm pretty active on Twitter. I'm at dmorin there. I write for Six Colors if you're interested in the technology side of things, and I host a couple podcasts, including Not Playing with Lex and Dan, as I mentioned, regular on The Incomparable, and I co-host a tech podcast called The Rebound with John Moltz and Lex Friedman.
And Clockwise.
And Clockwise with our friend Jason Snell.
Another tech podcast.
Another tech podcast. I do a lot of tech podcasts. Yeah.
You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned, episode 11, with Anthony Johnston and Dan Moran. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. If you're enjoying the show, please do consider taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes. It really helps. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Just the other night, I was sitting here with my friends, and I pulled out, I looked back at my bookcase and remembered I have a copy of, paperback copy of the novelization of Hudson Hawk.
Oh, wow.
Which I've never read. An ex-girlfriend bought it for me because she worked in a bookstore. And she's like, I saw this and I thought of you. And I was like, this is great. I've had it for years. I've never read it because I can't imagine that it's any good.
The hat convention line, I'd actually completely forgotten about.
Oh, God, I love that line so much. It always makes me giggle, you know, and for no reason, because it's not a great line, but there's just something with the way he delivers it. And the guy's head is rolling down the staircase and you're like, that doesn't make any sense, but it's also really funny.
But I think that's what's funny is that it is a terrible line. And you kind of get the feeling that he knows it's a terrible line, but he has to say something because he's just killed a dude.
Right, right.
And that's what you do.
He needs the Bond quip, right? Yeah. You know, shocking, you know, or whatever. And so, you know, he needs something because that's what it demands. That's what in some ways, the triumph of the film is that at the end, he decides to sort of like buy wholeheartedly into the world of the film.
Yeah.
And that's what enables him to succeed, is he's like, I'm just going to give up any pretense of resisting and sort of go with the flow. And that is the moment where his triumph comes out.
One of my favorite lines from the movie, and the only line apart from the whole sort of business of, oh, I remember the singing. But the only line that I remembered after sort of years after seeing it is when they're in the back of the car at the end.
You New York Italian father made $20 a week, son of a bitch.
Yeah.
It's such a crazy line, but and he delivers it.
He delivers
so well.
It very off the cuff, right? Like it's just a matter of course for him. He's just sort of speaking very casually, like, "Yeah, I just that's how I talk. I talk in complete like hyphenated expression sentences."
Oh, I love it. And I mean, yeah, as a I wasn't sure whether that line would be as funny to non-British people. I don't know. There's just something about it. That was the one line that my friends and I would shout at each other. You know, even the ones who didn't think the movie was that great, we all love that line.
That's the thing, is this movie to me is infinitely quotable, even though I, you know so few people who actually would recognize or know quotes. Though most of my friends have seen it and a lot of us enjoy it. But I, you know, I always think of myself, find things like, "Caesar, Anthony, are you guys okay?" After the ambulance has exploded into flame.
Bunny ball.